107.2 FM.
Radio Reverb.
Hey everybody, this is Lisa Moore for the Brighton Business Show here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. And this is our July show. So we're well into summer. The sun has been shining and it's been absolutely lovely. How are you, Helen?
I'm very well, thank you, Lisa. Very, very well indeed. It's all go leading up to the summer holidays, trying to cram as much in as possible before the 6 weeks off.
Yes, I know that feeling, although it's less of an issue for me now because my girls are a bit older now, but it's still that that thought of them being around all the time when you're trying to work from home.
Yes.
So what's been going on in your world since the last time we chatted on the show?
Yeah, so quite a lot's been happening. I've been continuing doing some really exciting corporate stuff, all around communication or verbal communication and influence negotiation. But a couple of exciting things are sort of happening in the Brighton area. I've actually just become a member of Soho House. Ooh, which is the new house that opened up in Brighton. Mm-hmm. And it's above the Sea Life Centre.
I know, yes, I've seen.
So I've actually, because I've known people who are members, and I've been, you know, with clients and met clients and done events in the London houses, but never been a member myself. So I'm very excited because it has a banana-shaped pool.
A banana-shaped pool? Swimming pool?
Swimming pool, yes. There's a co-working, restaurant, swimming pool. There's lots of events. So I'm having an induction. So that's going down there this week. So that'll be exciting. And I'm collaborating with a pub in the park. You know, Tom Kerridge?
Yes.
So he's putting on...
Not personally, but yes.
He's putting on a really fantastic event in September in Preston Park called Pub in the Park. And it's food, music, and like a festival vibe over 3 days. So I'm sort of working in partnership with them. And I'll be going along there. So it's coming up, everyone. So check it out. It's just like a family event with, you know, live demonstrations of food, loads of cooking, loads of music. Top Loader are going to be there. There's some really cool DJs. And that's all happening, I think it's the 16th to the 18th September.
Well, that sounds fantastic, Helen. I definitely have to find out a little bit more about that and come down and get involved.
Yes. What about you?
Well, yeah, I've had a busy month, actually. I've been doing some corporate work as well, and delivering some talks, some sort of health and wellness. They were going to be lunchtime, but it was 30 minutes at 3 with Lisa.
Cool.
Talking about things like avoiding burnout, which I think a lot of people are worried about at the moment. Getting over the fear of public speaking, which you and I both know quite a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
And tackling imposter syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Something that I've known in my life for a while, as I think a lot of people have, you know, that horrible feeling of feeling like you're a fraud and why am I here doing this when somebody else should be doing it so much better than me?
No one is safe from the imposter. It's just a natural human condition, I think. But sounds like some really meaty subjects there. I bet they were well received.
They were. It was really good, actually, because the company I was doing it for had been running this program pretty much since COVID hit, everybody working from home, etc. And over the last sort of 3 or 4 months, attendance to sessions and things like that had really dropped down. But I think I had about 70% of the people invited came along to the talk. So it's great for me. Big learning curve because I've not used Microsoft Teams before. I'm used to using Zoom, but Microsoft Teams was a little bit challenging.
Yeah, I don't like Teams, to be honest with you, especially when giving a talk. I think Zoom's the best for giving a virtual talk.
Yeah.
Exciting stuff.
Exciting stuff. And it's good to get out there and talk. And I'm looking forward to actually starting to do some more talks back in person, face to face.
One of the reasons why I mentioned those two things at the beginning is because for me, this second half of the year is all about connection and really getting out from behind the computer and connecting with people. I'm doing a chamber business walk
Oh, I did the chamber behind the scenes at the old police cells week, which was fascinating.
Oh, I would have loved to have gone to that. I missed that one. Yeah.
Worth a go, and I think the general public can go on a Saturday morning. I think it's £5 for the tour, but great place to take the kids for summer holidays. I think they'd really enjoy that.
Yeah,
but fascinating and interesting.
Yeah, there's some really good chamber events on. I think for anyone who's listening that is, you know, running a business within the Brighton area, it's really good thing to check in. They do all sorts of online events. This one I'm doing is across the Downs.
Yeah.
And you network in groups whilst walking. I think that's brilliant. That's way better for me than standing in a stuffy room in the summer. That's great. I'll have to check that out.
Look, and I think they've got a behind the scenes coming up. They're doing the tour of the Theatre Royal. So going, you know, underneath, and apparently there's a hidden tunnel. And all sorts of trapdoors and
things. Oh, I love things like that. It's when I found out there was a hidden tunnel between the pavilion and Brunswick Square, because Catherine of Brunswick lived there and the Prince Regent had the tunnel built so he could have a clandestine affair with her.
I know. Yeah, they do some really great events. So this month's show, we always like to have a theme for our show. And it's a subject that you and I actually don't know that much about. And it's about IP, intellectual property. So I looked up the definition on Google, as you do. And the definition of IP refers to creations of the mind, such as inventions, literary and artistic works, designs, symbols, names and images used in commerce. So, what do you understand to be IP, Helen? Because we both worked as coaches, and we worked as done a lot online and created courses, programs, all that sort of thing. What's your knowledge of IP now?
It's interesting because I guess I haven't really ever thought about it properly, but as we're talking, the things that are jumping out for me first are IP in relation to the corporate work I do. So when I am taken on board by an organisation, even when I was in-house working for an organisation, the content that I created, the courses, the programmes, the learning material was the property of the company.
Yes.
So that was quite clear. So when I was employed, that was really clear. It was crystal clear. And, you know, now when I do those sorts of things, it's not always original content because I'm drawing from theory, from psychological theory, from psychological methods and models and things like that. Yeah. But the way that I'm putting it together is my way of putting it together.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I used tried and tested approaches that I have created myself. So when I think about my IP, one of the things I actually work with clients is to create an expert method. So this is part of the AIRE assessment. I do this. It's authority, impact and reach. And the authority element is how to establish yourself as a unique thought leader in your field. One of the ways you can do that is by creating a brand. The other way is by getting your core story nailed. Another way is to really get ideas worth spreading out there. And another way is your expert method. The expert method to me is the form of IP, because what you're doing is you're creating something unique around your knowledge that is yours.
Yeah.
So it could be. So mine is my AIRE assessment.
Yes.
That particular model, that's mine. That's my IP. I've created an assessment from it. I've put all the things on the bottom that people can't copy it and all that sort of stuff. And I help people to do that for themselves, and whether it be, you know, around a compass, or it could be a step-by-step process, or it could be a formula, or it could be, you know, a tree, even the image of a tree with different facets to it. Because I know that you've got one of those yourself, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly. And I have this framework which I use within my Fit for More, within my coaching business, which is, well, you could call it four pillars, you could call it four steps, you could call it four areas, but it's the SHIP method. I always have to be a bit careful how I say that, but it's SHIP, So jump on board the ship, let's go on a journey, which is, it's all about four different areas that I believe when those are in alignment and they're sitting in alignment, you know, you're gonna go on a cruise liner and have a lovely cruise on a nice calm sea, and life is gonna be wonderful. So yes, I have that method. And I guess from my point of view, IP, when I first heard about it, I think my limited knowledge was all around copyrights, about patents, about your branding logo, you know, for example, the Golden Arches. Everybody knows the Golden Arches, but nobody else could copy them because they're copyrighted. And maybe we're making some assumptions here, and our guest on today's show, Stephen Carter, is an expert in the field of IP, and we're going to bring him on board and ask him some questions in a minute. But yeah, thinking about even the colours that you use. Virgin, for example, have the Virgin Red that everybody knows is their red.
Yes.
Is that patented? Is that copyrighted?
Yes.
Is it trademarked? There's those words that we hear branded about, which I am assuming, and we'll ask Stephen to confirm this, they're all part of IP and intellectual property.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you talk about colours. Going back to this just fun fact, Brunswick, Catherine of Brunswick and Brunswick Square in Brighton has a very particular shade of yellow that it's painted, and that is Brunswick cream. And that all of the buildings have to be painted in that
color,
in that very, very specific color. I mean, if it had one of those, you know, that all colors have codes to them, don't they? It's
they
got
do.
A very specific code, a hashtag code. But is that IP, you know, is that intellectual property, a color that people have to conform to, that's owned by someone? And, you know, when we think about content of courses and programs, gosh, you know, there have been quite a few instances over the years where, you know, people can take that stuff. And it happens all the time, and I see it everywhere. And I see colleagues, it happens to colleagues, and I've seen colleagues send cease and desist letters to people through legal means. And I'd have to mention Suzanne Dibble here, because she's actually someone who helps with those sorts of things, like templates and things like that, with things like cease and desist. But that's where I learned about it. But what's the law on that? You know, is it something that is very, it's not easily regulated, is it? Because there's no sort of centralized way of protecting things, or is there?
Radio Reverb.
97.2.
Radio Reverb.
And it's really interesting you say that, because as you were mentioning earlier, in the work that we do, you draw on knowledge that you've gained maybe through a course. So, for example, NLP.
Mm-hmm.
So you do an NLP course, and there are loads of different tools, techniques, things that you would then use with your clients, or you might create a course with some of those techniques built in that you have added your own magic to, for want of a better expression. But you've perhaps gone really like that, but I find it works better if I just do it that way round, or you add bits in. And I guess it would be really great for Stephen to sort of just to confirm some of those assumptions that we have and make it clear for people, because, you know, there are lots of court cases that go on around IP, and people may be naively not realizing that they need to take those into account. So I'm going to bring Stephen Carter in. It's really great to have you here with us, Steve. If you perhaps just give us a brief introduction to who you are, where you come from. I know you've got a lot of experience within this world. Tell us a bit more about who you are and where you've come from.
Sure, very happy to. And firstly, thank you for inviting me on. It's a pleasure to be here and to be chatting with you both. So as Lisa said, I'm Stephen Carter. I'm founder of the Intellectual Property Works, which is a consultancy business that works with startups and small, mainly technology businesses, but small businesses generally, to help them, I guess, help them understand the role that IP does play in their business and the importance of IP to their business. How did I get there and do that? So I've been in this business, this IP business, for over 20 years, quite a lot over 20 years now, actually. And spent most of that time in a couple of different law firms doing the very traditional legal thing. I'm qualified as a patent attorney, so helping people protect their inventions is at the core of what I used to do, what I still do to a degree. But just over 4 years ago now, I left the last law firm that I was a partner in and set up the Intellectual Property Works, say specifically aimed at helping smaller businesses. So taking all of that expertise and knowledge that I've built up over those 20 something years and making it available to smaller businesses in a way that's hopefully easily digestible and you know, pointing them in the right direction.
Fantastic. Thank you. Now, you listened to Helen and I just have that discussion about what we understood IP to be. And hopefully we got some of the areas right. But from your point of view, in simple terms, if you're a business owner, you've been in business a while, or maybe you're just starting up, what really is IP? I gave that definition, but what is IP?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think the definition you gave is quite a good general definition, but it doesn't necessarily tell businesses like really what IP is and what it means to them. And the discussion you had actually was really interesting because there are aspects of it. I mean, a lot of what you said is very true, and it's the kind of experience that a lot of small businesses have of IP, which is that they come across it once in a while and have to think about it a little bit, and then it goes to the back of their mind again. And most small businesses' experience of IP is a very kind of ad hoc experience. Either, you know, as you say, someone you become aware of someone misusing your brand or using some of your collateral that you've produced for your courses, or in the case of technology businesses, maybe, you know, using some of the tech that they've developed or misappropriating that. And you run around frantically trying to deal with it, and then you move on to the next thing. And one of the things we'll get onto, I'm sure, is that, you know, I'm a big believer in every business having a plan around their IP so that you don't have to be reactive and don't have to deal with it on an ad hoc basis. You can actually be proactive, which doesn't necessarily mean spending lots of money on it. And in fact, if you're organized and you have the right plan in place with your IP, it can mean that you can protect your business in a way that means you ultimately spend less money and you protect the value you're creating. But coming back to your question, which is what is IP, I think one of the ways of thinking about it, and I think a useful way of thinking about it as a small business, is IP is basically everything that you have in your business which has value, and which particularly is intangible. So the stuff you can't touch and feel, but that actually underpins a lot of the value in your business. So, you know, in the sorts of businesses that the two of you run, you gave some really great examples there of what your IP is. So it's brand is a really important thing, and it's worth getting into a bit more discussion about that. And I like your points about colors, and there's some interesting, you know, points we can talk about around that, but also, you know, all of the marketing collateral that you produce, all of the collateral that you produce, the content for, you know, the courses you run or the services you deliver to clients, all of that is IP. If for other sort of techie businesses, the software code that's being written for them that they're writing, that's IP. The technical innovation that's going on, that's generating IP. And the way I encourage businesses to think about it or look at IP generally is to think about two slightly different concepts. One is the concept of IP assets. So that's the stuff you're generating, the stuff that has the value or underpins the value in your business. So that is, you know, that's the content, it's the software code, it's the technical innovation, it's the business processes that you've designed, it's the app that you've created, it's the brand that you've designed or had designed for you. So those are the IP assets. That's where the value is. But then layered on top of that is this suite of intellectual property rights, So these are the legal rights that you can use to protect those underlying assets. So, for example, you have patents, which are a legal right that you have to apply for that protect technical innovation. You have registered trademarks that are the legal intellectual property right that protect elements of a brand. So they might, you know, protect your business or product or service names, your logos, and in some cases, colours. And we can touch on that again a bit later. And you have registered designs that protect the appearance of products. And these are all strong monopoly rights that you have to apply for and go through an application process to secure. And the strength of those rights is tested and determine whether your innovation warrants protection in that way. But there's also unregistered rights. So things like copyright, which is the one that most people can know about and understand a bit about, which protects content. It also protects software, importantly. Which is something that not everyone knows. It will protect things like logos. So in some cases, the underlying asset, so take the example of a brand logo, there might be more than one way that you can protect that. So it will probably have copyright protection if it's an original logo, but you could also, if you want to protect it more securely, you can apply for registered trademark protection for it.
I don't think I'd ever really thought about the differences between a trademark and copyright. I think I'd probably lumped them into the one and the same thing, because you hear these names, don't you? And how about you, Helen?
I'm thinking exactly the same. Yeah, I guess there was a blurred line between what those two were. Also, thinking about patents and things like that, on top of, as you say, is something on top, the rights on top of it. My dad invented a lot of things, but he never got them patented. Yeah. He came up with inline skates before inline skates were a thing.
If only he had taken good advice and patented it, you see, he could have been taking a royalty on that for 20 years, which is the life of a patent. My granddad was an inventor as well, actually, which I think is partly how I've ended up doing what I did. So he was an engineer, and that took me down the path of engineering, which then led on to getting involved in this world of patents and IP.
Right.
Wow. Was there anything that we would know that your grandfather invented?
The thing that's best well known that he invented. So he worked for the Admiralty, so it was mainly kind of naval technology. But he was one of the inventors of the steam catapult that launches aircraft off aircraft carriers.
Oh, wow.
So I bore my kids every time I see something. So we actually went to watch Top Gun Maverick at the weekend.
Yeah, what a good film that is.
So it was another excuse for me to go, oh, your great-granddad invented that. I'm like, yes, Dad.
I know that. You've told us 100 times. But that's fascinating, isn't it? That all these inventions, and then people don't do anything about it, and then somebody comes along and goes, oh, that's a good idea, I'll just change it. And
yeah, which again comes down to this kind of planning ahead and I guess recognizing that there is value in these things and having the plan in place to protect them. And you make a good point about, I guess not appreciating that there are these different forms of protection you can use. And when, what I'd encourage people to do is the starting point, something we've not mentioned yet, but IP, you can throw a lot of money at registering patents and trademarks and enforcing those rights. And I've come across too many small businesses who've got it in their head that they need to get patent protection or they need to get trademark protection. And they've emptied the money pot on applying for that without advancing their business, and then the business goes nowhere. So I think it's really important to recognise that intellectual property are kind of the assets that your business is built on. Intellectual property protection, so the intellectual property rights that you potentially have to spend money on, at the end of the day, they're just a business tool. They're about, and you need to be making commercial decisions about whether the right thing to do is to be spending money on these intellectual property rights, or whether some of the unregistered rights, which involve less expenditure, are more appropriate. And again, this comes down to having a plan. So unless you stop and think about it and work out what the options are, or have a conversation with someone about what the options are and put a plan in place, then, you know, you tend to make these knee-jerk decisions, spend, you know, potentially spend money unnecessarily, or don't spend money when you should be spending it, and you end up tripping up down the line.
It's interesting.
Sorry.
Oh, sorry, Helen. I was just thinking about Dragon's Den. It popped into my head because, you know, you get all these people that come on that have invented something, and all the dragons want to know is, you know, have you got a patent? Have you got a patent? Have you got a patent? And it, you don't really understand necessarily what that is. But I think from a, maybe from a physical invention, or I mean, software as well is the same sort of thing. It seems a bit more obvious that you need to think about those legal rights. But when it's less tangible, so creating a framework like Helen and I have talked about, her AIR framework and my ship method, that for me is a little bit more woolly. It's like, should I, shouldn't I? Will I, won't I? And so, I mean, going back, you've mentioned having this plan. Where do people start with the plan? What are the things that they need to consider first of all?
So I think there's when I talk to people about this, and I've done, you know, some presentations and webinars and things in the past, and I tend to talk about three main areas that you need to consider, and I could probably add a couple more to those, but one of the key things, and one of the things that people overlook often, particularly smaller businesses, is around ownership of IP. And people make assumptions, and the biggest one being, I've paid for it, therefore I must own it, which, uh-huh, you know, is logical and you think should be the case, but actually for some forms of IP isn't. So you take the example, you know, I've worked with clients in the past where they've engaged an agency to write software code for them. And as we mentioned earlier, one of the IP rights associated with software code is copyright. Mm-hmm. And what the law says about copyright is that the first owner is the person who's created the copyright work. So in this case, the person who's written the software code. And if they're employed, then most often that means that the law works to mean that their employer owns that copyright. Yeah. But what the law doesn't do is automatically transfer ownership of that copyright to the customer that's paid for it. So if you're engaging a contractor, and it works the same for, say, a branding agency or someone that's a copywriter who's writing content for you, or someone who's typesetting your words into a nice, pretty worksheet, or if these people aren't employees, and yeah, the nature of small business is, you know, I'm a small business as well, we all reach out to third parties to help us pull things together and provide input to growing our business. So the default, you can find yourself in a position because of the way the default law works, that if you don't have the right agreements in place with these people you're working with, you don't actually own this valuable IP asset that you're growing your business on. Now, you'll find that if you're working with these external, you know, people who are writing software code, people who are designing stuff for you, most of the time their standard terms will say something along the lines of, so long as you pay us, we'll transfer, or we transfer the copyright to you.
Mm.
But that's not always the case. And I've certainly seen more than a handful of examples in the past where the standard contracts of these people don't do that. Well, they only give you sort of limited use of the thing they're creating for you, and they try and hold on to some of the ownership so they can use it in other scenarios. So that's a starting point, I think, for a lot of these things, is just making sure you own this valuable stuff that your business is creating. And that's what that involves is just, I guess, partly being aware, but thinking about the relationships you've got. So I sort of talk sometimes to people about an IP relationship map. So just the idea of kind of mapping out the relationships that your business has with all the people that are working and inputting on, this great stuff that your business is being built on, and just making sure that you understand the nature of all those relationships and that the agreements that govern them work to ensure that all of the IP flows down into your business where you want it to be, rather than leaking out and being retained elsewhere. Yeah.
It's not that, that's not something that I was aware of at all. How about you, Helen? Is it something you knew about?
I guess no. But what I'm trying to do is trying to understand what does that mean for someone, you know, a service based solo business owner such as myself, where the IP is in the content, and I guess the learning that you're imparting in whatever form that you're imparting it, be it a self-study course where it's like it's there, something to buy, and that people work through that themselves, or whether it's a program you're delivering. I guess I'm finding hard to grasp what that actually looks like for that type of business model. That type of business.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it is, you used the term woolier before, and it is and it isn't. It's woolier in the sense, or it's more difficult in the sense that there is no kind of overarching protection to say, I just want to protect my framework or my workshop or my course. Because I guess ultimately the way the law works is, it's about encouraging innovation and competition, and monopolies that stop other people doing something similar are generally perceived as a bad thing, because they potentially are a barrier to innovation and a barrier to you know, growth of the economy generally. And these intellectual property rights are sort of exceptions to that that are put in place, but they're quite specific exceptions that apply to specific types of IP asset. So with a business like yours, what you have to do is sort of look at the constituent elements of your framework or your course and say, right, what are there protectable assets there? And there will be, and there'll be lots of them. So all of the collateral that you create specifically for your delivery of your services will have copyright protection if it's original. And so the conversation we were just having about ownership, that's relevant, because if you're getting someone else to produce any of that for you, or do the sort of layout and design, if you want to own that and have it and yours exclusively that other people can't make use of, then you need to make sure that you own the copyright in it. The other really important IP right for people delivering business services like you is actually trademarks and trademark protection. Because if you think about it, I guess the question to ask is, why do people come to you for your services rather than go to other people? And so that there'll be some kind of USP that you offer, or but a lot of that, I suspect, not quite trying to put words into your mouth, but a lot of it will be about reputation. And word of mouth and referrals and good reviews on websites and other platforms. So that's all about reputation. And actually, reputation is associated with your business name and your business logo or your personal name, or so it's, and what trademark protection allows you to do is to stop other people either damaging that reputation or riding on your coattails and benefiting from that reputation.
Radio Reverb. With my first business, this actually came up quite glaringly, because the name that I came up with was similar to an American company that were doing similar things. And I had to look into trademarks, and it was a different name, but the services were similar. And I contacted them, and we had big, loads of discussions around it. And I looked into trademarking. At the time, it was my first business. I didn't have any money, and I ended up not pursuing it. So I think that's something that's really important, isn't it? Because as you say, trademarking is the thing to do over copywriting. But it has, as you say, it's a tool, and it's what would probably be useful is helping people make the decision on the pros and cons of that, really, because it does cost money, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so trademarks are they're geographically limited. So, you know, you can get a UK trademark registration, which will give you protection in the UK. And you can get a US trademark registration that will give you protection in the US and so on. You get a European one, which will give you protection in the EU, and it goes on. So one of the decisions and one of the things that you would include in your plan would be, right, what territories are important to me and what territories do I need to protect in? And that's generally around, like, where are my markets? So for a lot of small UK-based businesses, the UK will be their key primary market, and that will be the most important place to protect their brand. And they may then sort of be a bit forward thinking and say, well, actually, my next target market is the EU, or my next target market is the US. So let's start putting in place the plan to get my brand protected there as well. The flip side of this is you also, like, we're talking about pros and cons. So I guess the pros, so yes, you have to spend money on it. If you just want protection in the UK, the costs aren't that high. I mean, it depends on the size of the business and looking at what you're investing in your brand and the collateral around that. And this is sort of a bit like having insurance for that. Mm. So the UK IPO, which is the kind of government organisation that administers patents, trademarks, registered designs in the UK, their application fees for trademarks start at £170. In practice, you can go directly to the UK IPO and you can file your own trademark registration. The reality is that if you want to be sort of confident that you're doing it the right way and that you're covering, you're giving yourself the coverage you want, then it does make sense to speak to an expert and get their help. And then that obviously that pushes the costs up by another few hundred pounds. But at the end of the day, you know, the consequences, the potential consequences of not doing that could be much greater. So I've worked with clients in the past where they've not taken steps early to register their trademark, and they've ended up in a spat, a fight with someone down the line over their use of the name, because someone else has managed to register it, even though they might have been operating for a shorter period of time. It's kind of a first come, first serve system. So they've registered it. And the upshot in a couple of cases for clients has been that they've had to rebrand, and that's, you know, that can be an expensive process, plus that the damage it might have done to your reputation in the meantime. So by thinking about it and planning for it and building it into your budgets for your business, you can get your protection. And I think, you know, IP protection, one way of thinking about it is like insurance. So you sort of hope that you never have to rely on it. And it means that for a lot of businesses, they see it as a cost. Yeah, it's a cost. It's something that takes away from the bottom line. Mm. It's not something that you can say, by doing this, I'm going to improve the top line. But it's about having that insurance in place.
Yeah, it's protection, as you say. You know, casting back to my sort of my young, naive first business head, and, you know, what happened there and everything. I see it all very differently now. So it's that's I don't know what you think about that, Lisa. It's really cleared it up for me.
Well, yeah, fascinating. I'm learning a lot, actually, definitely learning a lot. I guess it's not something that I even thought about when I first started up. It just didn't come into my mind, because it wasn't something I knew about. And I think that's the problem with you know, businesses when you're starting up. There are so many things that you have to learn, and you don't know what you don't know until you know. And I guess that's where networking can really help. You know, when you're going out there and you're networking with other business people, and you come across experts like Stephen, and that's how I met Stephen in the first place, was through a sort of a masterminding group, and sort of knew a little bit about IP, but not much. But it's really helpful to, when you network, to talk to all these different people and understand the lessons that they've learned. So going back to the planning, having that plan in place, is there sort of like a very simplified step-by-step plan that you could say, right, this is the first thing you need to do, this is the second thing you need to do, this is the third thing, and then is there a regular review process that you need to go through? Can you simplify it in 5 minutes?
I mean, top level, it's kind of a process, I guess, I follow with my clients if I'm working with them for this, doing, you know, for this sort of thing, helping them get a plan in place. Is, and coming back to the point about IP and IP rights being, you know, business tools, commercial tools, for me, the starting point always has to be like, where's the value? Let's identify, understand how you're either making money or planning to make money as a business, and what your kind of growth plans are. So let's understand the business. So, and hopefully most small businesses will understand that, but some, you know, some haven't even stopped to think about actually, you know, where are the revenue streams and how are they making money? And let's make sure we've got that recorded and written down. And then, so having identified where the value is and how as a business you're going to be making money. So that's kind of step one. Step two is working out, well, what are the underlying assets that allow me to do that? And that allow me to do it, I guess, better than the competition or in a different way to the competition. You know, what is it that is going to allow my business or that I'm building my business on that makes me think I'm going to succeed and carry on making, generating that revenue or generate the new revenue? And those assets, that kind of, you know, that collateral or the you know, the inventions or the product designs or the software code or the apps, all of these things that support that revenue generation, that's your key IP, that's your kind of important valuable IP. So that step two is identifying what those IP assets are. Then step three is checking that you actually own those assets. So yeah, so you've worked out where the value is, you've worked out what the IP assets are that underpin that value, and then you've worked out whether you own it, and if you don't, working out kind of what the remedial action that's required to make sure you do. And then you can think about the protection piece, which is, you know, given that these are the assets I've got, what protection already exists? Because some of these things come into existence automatically. So like copyright exists, comes into existence automatically. Trade secrets might be a valuable form of protection for some businesses. So that's basically just, if you can keep something secret and it has value to the business because you're keeping it secret, then that's a protectable piece of IP in effect. Yeah, the classic example is like, you know, the KFC.
The recipe.
I mean, they're the classic examples, but, you know, things like software code or the algorithms that you're running your app on, if you can keep those, you know, under the hood and not ever disclose them, that can be really valuable. And that's, you know, some sort of coming back to one of the comments you made earlier about Dragon's Den always banging on about patents. Have you got a patent? Have you got a patent? One of the downsides of going down the patent route is that you necessarily have to disclose to the world what you're doing and how you're doing it.
Of course.
And you know, a lot of investors, not just in Dragon's Den, but you know, other investors as well, bang that patent drum quite regularly. And one of the things that I work with clients to do sometimes is to have their kind of their IP story ready for when they're seeking investment. Because sometimes patents aren't the best way. Sometimes being able to keep things secret as a trade secret can be the, you know, the stronger form of protection at the end of the day. And so if you can put a small business in a position, you know, when they're seeking investment, an investor goes, where are your patents? Rather than them go, I'm not sure, we haven't got any, we can't really afford them. If they are able to turn around to that investor and say, well, actually, we've taken advice on that, and for our product or the service we're offering, patents aren't really the best form of protection, and it's much better to use trade secrets and copyright as we do, and we've got this nice record of what we've got and how it's protected, then you kind of overcome that potential hurdle.
Can I just ask a question? So then with trade secrets, is there's a process behind that as well, that is defined, or
it's so that there's not a defined process in the sense that there's no kind of formal registration.
Mm-hmm.
But with a lot of the unregistered rights, what it comes down to that is, if you ever want to enforce them, the onus is very much on you to demonstrate that you have the right in the first place and that you own it, and being able to show that someone has stolen it, basically. Okay. So a lot of that comes down to having really good records. So record keeping is one of the drums I bang when I'm talking to clients, but having good records of, you know, what was created when, who it was created by. And for trade secrets, so that, you know, the law has evolved over the last 5 to 10 years. And so there's confidential information. It's just, you know, stuff that you keep secret that you don't. And you know, people are familiar with the idea of NDAs, so non-disclosure agreements, and making sure you get those signed before you share information. Trade secrets are sort of a special form of confidential information that the law defines. And basically, it's confidential information, it's secret stuff that has value to the business because it's secret. And you have to demonstrate that you're taking appropriate steps to look after it. And there's no kind of formal definition of what those appropriate steps might be, but it is, you know, it's things like making sure you've got the right agreements in place. So you've got contractual protection.
Yeah.
With anyone that you're sharing that information with. Yeah, you know, it's things like, even within your own business, limiting access to those really juicy trade secrets only to those people within the business that need to know it. Which can then be having the right kind of technical protection in place as well. So if you've got the right IT security, that means it's not easy for other people to you know, get into your systems and steal this stuff.
Fascinating.
It's like the reggae source that was actually a Dragon's Den investment.
It was.
And that particular ingredient within the source must be a trade secret. And the manufacturers that they appointed to make the sauce within the warehouses must have come under a trade secrets, you know, agreement.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mm. No, yeah. I want to have a trade secret. I want to have something.
I'm racking my brains here now to think, what is it that I know that I haven't told anybody about my business and how it works? But
no. It's a bit more tricky for people like us, but when it's like, you know, Nonna's secret recipe, you know, that was centuries old, goes back through generations within an Italian family, or, you know, that's much more sort of, I guess, common with a trade secret software algorithm, you know, code, that type of thing. But I'm gonna make it a mission to come up
and sort of technical know-how, you know, and maybe details about how you manufacture something. You know, if that's all done behind closed doors and you don't need to tell people about it, all of these things are things that are potentially extremely valuable because they're the thing that, you know, often gives you the competitive edge, but you can keep them secret. Or you can try and protect them with a patent, which means they get published, but you hopefully have the patent protection. So they're the kind of decisions that people have to make. But if you, rather than sort of make them every time you come up with a new idea, if you have your IP plan in place, then it'll, you know, you sort of, part of the IP planning is you think about what new innovations or what types of new innovation are likely to come along, given what our development processes are or our plans are. And let's have a framework now, basically. That's all an IP plan is, a framework that when we get to those decision points, helps us make those decisions efficiently and allows us to budget for, you know, what are the cost consequences of making those decisions. And,
I'm just thinking of lots of things now, and I'm thinking about, you know, those pants that revolutionised the women's, you know, feminine product industry.
They're just a rejig of an old-fashioned corset, aren't they, Helen?
You know, the menstrual.
Oh, the ones you're talking about, yeah. So
there was one company that came out with that's the new innovation.
Mm.
Now I see lots of different companies doing it, and it's like, oh, well, what happened there? Because that was a very, very specific new bit of technology that revolutionized how women could live their lives. But now there's other companies doing the same thing. So was it not protected, or was there loopholes in that protection, or what happened there?
Yeah. And it could be either of those things, Or it could be that there's licensing arrangements in place in the background that we don't know about. Or it could be, you know, again, we haven't really talked much about the enforcement or the risk side of things. So one of the other things that an IP plan ought to address is the risk side of things.
Yeah.
Which is there a risk that what I'm doing commercially will infringe someone else's rights? Taking brand again as an example, because I think it's kind of, you know, it's something that every business has. If you're choosing a new brand for your business, one of the things you ought to do is check to make sure that no one else has that name already registered for similar goods or services that you're going to be offering under it, because you could just be running it, creating an issue for yourself. So it's possible to search public registers of trademarks to see whether anyone else has registration for a similar mark.
And where do people go to do that, Stephen?
So there are public databases. So the UK IPO, as I said, the government organisation that administer trademark applications, patent applications, they have some searchable databases that you can search, or you can commission someone to do them for you.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say something else there. The other thing is, I was going to mention, so that a lot of the kind of reference libraries, the bigger reference libraries, have IP sections and people there that can help. So, in fact, I was talking to someone the other day who comes from down your way, and there's a business and IP centre, is what they call them.
BIPC, yes, I think.
In Jubilee Library in Brighton.
That's right, yes.
So there's a big service like that in the British Library. But some of the bigger regional libraries have these business and IP centres. So there's a lot, there's quite a lot of free advice. And, we come back to education being one of the really important points around this. But you need to know that there's stuff that you ought to know to even reach out and try and engage with some of those education opportunities. But, the UK IPO have quite a lot of information on their website that's accessible to small businesses. And then you have these BIPCs. In local libraries, which are worth engaging with if you're starting a small business.
Radio Reverb.
97.2. Radio Reverb.
I met somebody from the BIPC, funnily enough, at one of the Brighton Chamber events that we were talking about Brighton Chamber earlier. And I think there's a very close relationship between Brighton Chamber and the BIPC. And they do lots of mini courses and events. And I think you can book an appointment and go down and spend an hour with somebody there, and they'll help you with, the things that you need to know if you're setting up a new business. So that's definitely really good advice. There was something that you mentioned earlier that I just wanted to pick up on, where you talked about copyright becoming being automatic. I don't know whether I heard it right, but my understanding in its naive way is, if you write something, then that becomes copyrighted. Can you just expand on that a little bit more?
So copyright is one of these unregistered rights, and it does. It comes into existence automatically when you first create an original copyright work, and the copyright work might be, so obviously people think about it most often in terms of, you write a novel or you paint a picture, but any original kind of literary or artistic work, and an artistic doesn't mean it has to be like good. It just means, so if you sketch out a process diagram that's, taking people through your ship process or your air process, I think is what it's called, then that, if it's original, in the sense it's a new diagram that hasn't been drawn before, then copyright will be created there and then. And because you're the one that's created it, the one that's drawn it,
that makes sense.
You become the owner of that copyright.
Yeah.
But if someone else copies that diagram, And it has to be, I guess, one of the things with copyright and these other unregistered rights is there has to be copying for there to be infringement. So if someone thinks up the same thing independently and ends up creating something that looks very similar or even identical, if it's their own independent creation and they haven't actually copied it from you, then there's nothing you can do to stop them. Right. So one of the things with copyright is you have to be able to prove that someone did actually copy you. Whereas the registered rights, so patents, registered trademarks and registered designs, are true monopoly rights. So it doesn't matter whether the person that's infringing it knows who you are, has ever seen any of your products. If they produce a product or if they use a brand that falls within the scope of the protection that your right gives you, then they infringe. You're going to be irrespective of what their motivation was and whether they copied you or not. So they are stronger rights in that regard, but you have to pay to get them.
Wow.
So with copyright, things we touched on before, it does come down to, you know, the onus is on you to prove that you've got it. So if someone has copied you, then you'll have to show that it was your original work. And again, it comes down to just having good record keeping.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's been really, really fascinating, Stephen, talking to you and understanding a little bit more about intellectual property. Now, I know that you have a scorecard, which I assume you've trademarked, patented, copyrighted, and all that sort of thing, which can help small businesses. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that? And also, how can people connect with you if they want to get in touch to have a conversation?
Yeah, sure. So the scorecard is something that I've designed fairly recently, and it's just a really simple set of questions that the person taking the scorecard answers. Only takes a couple of minutes, and it gives them some feedback on their approach to IP as a business. It's aimed, I guess I'd say it was aimed mainly at techie businesses.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean other businesses can't take it. And it asks you for your name and email. And if you provide that, then you get sent a PDF report afterwards, which says tailored based on your answers. So it gives you some pointers as to where you might, where there might be room for improvement in your approach to IP, and gives some valuable information, feedback to businesses like that.
Yeah.
Right.
And we'll get the link from you for that, but it's investment-ready-ip.scoreapp.com. Is that right?
That sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah, sounds about right. But we'll put it in the show notes and make sure that people can find it.
Yeah.
And so if somebody wants to connect with you?
So LinkedIn is probably the best place to connect with me. And again, I can let you have the link for that. I think you've got that there. I'm sort of fairly active on LinkedIn, so feel free to follow me and hopefully pick up some other useful IP tips through that as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Stephen. It's been a really great show. Do you agree, Helen?
Yeah, it's been really, really enlightening. And I know for a lot of people who are very similar to us, which are a lot of people that listen to this show, it's going to be super, super useful. So definitely give Stephen a follow. I certainly will be. So that I can really get my head around it more and understand what that means for me and what I can do about it. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah. You're welcome. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's been fantastic. So this is Lisa Moore and Helen Packham for the Brighton Business Show here on Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM. This show will be available to listen again on the website and also to be downloaded as a podcast on your favourite podcast app. I very much look forward to seeing you again next month, Helen, and we'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.
Radio Reverb.